Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host for this morning's program. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Today is Labor Day. It's also as close as the Old Mole program will get to 9/11 this year. Not that 9/11, but the September 11th, 1973 overthrow by a U.S.-backed military junta of the democratically elected, democratically functioning government in Chile. It's also fall fundraising drive. Taking each of those, Labor Day, 9/11 in Chile, and the KBOO fall drive, taking each of them in reverse order, let's begin with the fall drive. As you'll hear later in the program, KBOO has been the only station to offer access to the library workers of Multnomah County in their struggle against layoffs. This is an extraordinary resource for the community, providing thoughtful coverage of what's covered only superficially elsewhere, or isn't covered at all. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 2020 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Community radio around the country has been forced to cut back or close. The dedicated staff and volunteers here in Portland have kept KBOO going strong. If you're able, please help. That's at kboo.fm/donate, or mail a check to the station. Thank you. Now to our program. This Friday marks 47 years since the coup that brought a military dictatorship to power in Chile and squelched a cultural and political flourishing. Chilean folk music, with Violeta Parra and Victor Jara, was inspirational for people around the world. It was seen as so much of a threat by the military junta that they targeted its practitioners in gruesome ways. Our music today is Victor Jara's El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, The Right to Live in Peace. Later in the program, I'll talk with Joe Clement, a union member and worker in the Multnomah County library system. We'll talk about the impact management proposed layoffs will have both on workers and on the community, their differential impact on workers of color and communities of color, and the kinds of initiative workers are taking as they organize. Bill Resnick will interview Marianne Lavelle from the publication Inside Climate News. They'll discuss Joe Biden's plans on infrastructure and energy, how those plans have evolved to include many of the elements of the Green New Deal, energy democracy plans proposed by Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and whether and how they can actually be won and implemented. To lead off the program, Patricia Kohlberg follows up her recent interview with Naomi Nikinsky on racism built into medical concepts. Today, Patricia speaks with Leslie Gregory, a local health practitioner and leader in the campaign to get racism declared a public health emergency. Before turning to Patricia and Leslie, here's just a touch of Victor Jara.
El derecho de vivir, poeta Ho Chi Minh, que golpea de Vietnam a toda la humanidad. Ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal. El derecho de China es el lugar más allá del ancho mar, donde revientan la flor con genocidio y napalm. La luna es una explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir en paz.
Victor Jara, The Right to Live in Peace. Now, here's Patricia with her guest, Leslie Gregory.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I am here today with activist Leslie Gregory. Leslie is a Navy veteran and a physician assistant who is practicing here in Portland. Now, I want to say for listeners who might not know, a physician assistant is a health practitioner, much like a nurse practitioner, who is licensed to independently diagnose and treat medical problems. Leslie Gregory is also at the forefront of the campaign to get racism declared a public health emergency. She is the founder and director of the local nonprofit Right to Health, whose vision is to create a network, a national network of healthcare providers, scientists, and community leaders who are committed to dismantling the effects of racism across all ethnic groups. Hundreds of cities and counties and states across the country have moved to formally declare racism a public health emergency with the intent to direct attention and resources toward anti-racist policies and programs. And this campaign, as you might imagine, has accelerated quite a bit in the context of the current public health crisis of the pandemic and the uprising against racism. Good morning, Leslie Gregory, and welcome to The Old Mole.
Hi, thank you.
The Old Mole recently aired a podcast about the radical public health programs of the Black Panthers. Leslie, you have your own history with the Black Panthers. I'd like to start with your personal story and how the Panthers inspired you.
That's a really great question. I appreciate it. My grandmother, Louise Booker, had one of the first Black-owned businesses in my hometown, and it was centered right in the middle of what was called then the Black community, now what would be known as the hood. And so right at door in Detroit, my grandmother's beauty shop was located, and directly across Door Street was the Black Panther headquarters. At that time, my only real relationship to the Black Panthers was that and driving by it every Saturday to get my hair done. And I was always struck by the facade of the building, which was heavy brick, concrete, a facade with tiny little slits in it. And I always thought, wow, that looks like a bunker. You know, it looks just like the war movies that you saw. And I always thought, what must be on the other side that it would need protection in that way? You know, when all I'd heard about the Black Panthers at that point was that they had started some kindergarten programs. They were doing some feeding of the poor, you know, particularly children. And the, of course, the pictures that you saw, the berets, you know, the black berets and the powerful countenance of the fist raised and the proud awareness of blackness, you know, and that was really my only awareness of their reputation in the community, that they were there to do good and to protect the children.
And your mother was, I believe, a nurse. So tell us a little bit about how you did get involved with the Panthers and with their health programs and what your mother's relationship to the Panthers was.
My mother was a staunch Lutheran. And in fact, she was the first Black nurse to graduate from the St. Vincent Medical School, Nursing School, although she'd been turned down the first year just because she was Black. No other reason, because she was very well accomplished in high school. And so for that year that she awaited her second chance to apply, she went to the university there. And there was a mild presence of the Panthers there on the university campus. My mother, I think, saw the model of taking care to the people. And that's how the Black Panthers delivered their care, was to bring care to the people. As a nurse, that's what she did. She started a mobile unit taking care to the people rather than expecting them to come to care.
And did you work in the clinic at all?
Yes, it was a mobile unit, and it went into communities testing at first for sickle cell and then for the components of the metabolic syndrome, cholesterol, sugar, etc. And yes, I was there, you know, poking fingers with her and talking to people about their results and changes they need to make. Yes. And that's what my protocol is based on now, currently.
Yes. Well, tell us a little bit more about your vision, not necessarily what you're doing now professionally, but how you see health services, how they should be provided to a community that's long been excluded from mainstream medicine in big ways?
Well, again, I think the issue is to bring the care to the people in their communities where they're more comfortable and feel safer and much more likely to comply, because the people delivering that service will have a much more will appear closer to the community. It will also help to mentor people of color into medicine, because that's how I got into it, was watching my mother and the care she provided. And so that's what my protocol involves, is a mobile unit going into communities at events and cultural events, etc., to bring this care to the people and talk to them about how managing chronic diseases can overall reduce risk, including for things like COVID, but also heart disease, diabetes, these sorts of things.
So you see your program as not only bringing services to a community in a way that meets them in their own communities and is sensitive to the kinds of health problems that they face, but is also a space for inspiring people of color to become health professionals.
Right.
And then perhaps also to help organize communities around health issues. Is that part of the vision as well?
Correct. Health issues being in the macro as well as micro terms. So for instance, a mobile unit could bring in reading materials about weight reduction, diabetes, risk management, healthy foods, etc. But it also would talk to the issues of food deserts, bring voting materials so that you're looking big picture as well. Also, what would happen at these events, and again, they can be either organized by the campaign. We could say to them, hey, let's have a health fair, or it can already be at an event like a Juneteenth or a Cinco de Mayo holiday. And the idea would be, instead of bringing patients into the clinic where blood pressure may be factitiously elevated when you're anxious and you don't feel comfortable, actually getting that baseline blood pressure without that sort of stress involved and more accurate. Also, people in their own communities would be able, instead of being worried about patient privacy issues, a lot of times I find people will actually share with each other their results. Oh, look, my triglycerides are a little higher than yours. Oh, look, my total cholesterol is lower than yours. What can we do? Those sorts of community events bring people together to collaborate around health. And that is another way that communities not only become more cohesive for themselves, but may share and help each other be more healthy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There is lots of literature to support the notion that communities that are socially cohesive are communities that have better health outcomes.
Absolutely. So for instance, if you have access to an automobile, you can say to your friend, look, I'll go get a big, huge bag of salad, bring it home instead of yours where it may rot because you haven't had a chance to get the size that is most appropriate for you. As well as, hey, let's walk together. You know, we talk about how to get your good cholesterol up a little bit. How about you walk with me? These are some of the things that we know not only reduce stress and increase safety, a feeling of safety in your communities. If you don't feel comfortable walking alone, hey, let's start a walking group, thing like that. So these are ways that we know communities can encourage each other to be more healthy. And that saves everybody, not just money, lives. You know, precious healthcare dollars certainly is always an issue.
One thing you had mentioned to me in an earlier conversation was your sense that for there to be real progress on dismantling racism in this country, the non-minority population needs to see it in their interest. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that idea?
Well, absolutely. You know, the practice that I have here in Oregon, it's largely not affected communities. You know, as you know, there's a very low percentage of people of color here. However, I have had my patients come in and express a great deal of discomfiture at what they're seeing, whether it's the violence in communities or, you know, inequitable treatment, etc. And so understanding that this will also reduce the stress, anxiety, what we call cognitive dissonance in majority culture will also help and help people to behave out of what we call enlightened self-interest. Once you realize that there's a lot of waste of your own taxpayer dollars in the mistreatment of others, then you'll begin to say, wow, you know, who's getting all the money from these prisons that perhaps are, you know, inundated with people who don't necessarily need to be there? You know, who's making that money? Because I'm paying for it. And so this is just a small example. But we know that $2.4 billion a year, and that's a very conservative estimate, that our whole country is paying in health disparities, $2.4 billion. Let's think about what else we could do with that money. Because that is not just coming from people of color. And so what we know is enlightened self-interest can also reduce stress in the general population.
I agree with that. And I think there's considerable international epidemiological research that supports the idea that everyone, rich or poor, black, white, or brown, all suffer the adverse effects of a deeply unequal society. Obviously, those who are the targets of racism suffer the most, but the lives of rich white people or middle-class white people are also degraded as well.
Exactly. And also seeing that in the data that white male mortality and morbidity is on the rise, but one would not expect that. And so we have to dial that in too. We have to do our research and find out what's going on there. And I think that may be related.
You're thinking that that is part and parcel of living in a society where the race gaps and the income gaps are getting larger.
Well, and I think there's another gap that people rarely speak about that I think is just as relevant, which is called the empathy gap. That idea that you could never be in the position of the people you're hearing about. The idea that you would think, all they had to do is comply. They shouldn't have been doing, you know, fill in the blank. And this idea that, oh, that would never be me. And then when you see this kind of, you know, continuing and escalating violence, it's called cognitive dissonance. When on the one hand, you're thinking, this could never be me. But on the other hand, you're looking at what they're doing and thinking, wow, I don't see what they did wrong there. you know, maybe that could be me. And these are the kinds of mixed messages that our brains find quite stressful. You know, a two opposites cannot exist at the same time.
Right. I think the George Floyd video did a lot to dispel or reduce that empathy gap that you're talking about.
And again, when you think about, you know, I'm voting, you know, I'm going to the polls. Is my voice being heard when I go to the polls? And the idea that, you know, no, a lot of people feel disconnected from, you know, their own government. And so, again, that stress just increases. And I believe that you have to think when you're looking at these events constantly happen, what do I call it when I get to do the things that would end someone else's life? What would it be like to be pulled over for a simple moving, speeding, whatever violation in my life versus someone else who may be doing the exact same thing wrong, and yet it may end their life?
Mm-hmm. Leslie, can you give our listeners a way to get involved with your particular campaign? Tell us how they could get in touch with you.
Okay. Very simple. I am on social media, so it's very simple to look me up on Facebook, Twitter. This is the place where Right to Health, R-I-G-H-T, to Health, is featured fairly prominently. You can find me there. You can get involved in the campaign by simply going to moveon.org. We have a campaign there that is, you know, you can just type in racism and public health, and you can find our campaign there.
Leslie, thank you very much for talking with me today about the very important anti-racist work that you're doing, and particularly from a public health perspective. Thanks very much. This has been Patricia Kohlberg speaking today with founder and director of Right to Health, local activist Leslie Gregory.
Thank you, Patricia Kohlberg and Leslie Gregory. Inside Climate News is an important web source on climate change. Bill Resnick now talks with one of its journalists, Marianne Lavelle.
Hi, Marianne Lavelle. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here with you.
Marianne Lavelle is a journalist, has the national politics beat on the publication Inside Climate News. It's an important web source for those concerned with climate change and preventing climate cataclysm and of course, what's going to come with it, mass death. Marianne has written a series of important pieces on the many competing plans for stopping climate change now circulating in the national government. There's at least three plans and several versions of each. They don't include plans from the Trumpies, of course, because it's a hoax, and he's for full speed ahead on anything that'll make money. But there is a corporate plan that's been developed by a group of congressional moderates from both parties with money from corporate America, including some of the oil companies. Marianne has reported on that plan. All the companies and who are part of it recognize that climate change is real, and they can make money from it, just from the research grants. And though the corporate plan is little noticed, some of it is likely to be implemented. But opposing the corporate plan, there's another plan, the plan from the left called Energy Democracy, which is being pushed in Congress by Oregon's own Senator Merkley, as well as Bernie Sanders and the crew in the House of Representatives. It calls for a network of public electric utilities, basically public electrical utilities run democratically, confederated in regions, building up sun and wind energy in their locality, as well as working with all the movements in their area, like around transit and housing, to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Finally, the third plan, there's the Biden plans, both announced in the last 3 months. It's got a lot of corporate-friendly provisions, but it has also evolved to include many programs from the left, from the Energy Democracy program. So, Marianne Lavelle, we're going to be talking about the Biden plans, their evolution, especially those elements that move in energy democracy directions, and finally, whether and how they can be implemented. First, tell us about the Biden plans.
Joe Biden really evolved in his thinking about approaching climate, and I think that was for two reasons. First, the very vigilant advocacy of progressives on climate change and his realization that he needs to bring them into behind him if he is going to win the presidency. He really needs that enthusiasm of progressives behind him. And the second thing that happened was just the devastation of the pandemic, both health and economic. And very much like, I think it's not too much to say that it's like the situation of FDR. If he is elected, he is going to be facing devastation on all fronts. And there has to be a rebuilding. And it makes no sense to build things back the way they were when the way they were left us in this situation where we're not resilient. We're not resilient in a health or economic sense, and certainly not in the climate sense. So that's why when he says build back better, it really is about creating something new. And he's brought in these ideas in his original plan. It just didn't have anywhere near the detail or the sense that, say, Bernie Sanders' plan had and Jay Inslee's plan had. So when Biden came out last month with this revamped plan, the remark he made that I think kind of stands for what the difference is he said, we're not tinkering around the edges. When you talk about things like infrastructure, which is, you know, a kind of traditional federal government spending plan would be infrastructure, and you would talk about roads and bridges. But he talks about that every one of the decisions on those roads and bridges has to be made with climate in mind. And it doesn't just mean roads and bridges. It means green spaces. It means water systems and clean water for communities, all communities. And it means building resilience to the impacts of climate change, which we're already seeing. So it very much is a far more holistic plan, as well as putting a lot more money and a lot more rapid time frame on what he hopes to achieve.
Right. What impressed me about the second plan was the multiple suggestions that he is ready to incorporate many of the programs of the Sanders plan, the Ocasio-Cortez plan, that is the energy democracy plan. For example, he has several statements saying that the plan has a preference for updating the existing grid and not needing what investor-owned utilities want. A huge amount of money to build continent-spanning new grids, highly expensive, snaking through forests and across waters, environmentally expensive in every conceivable way. And they're also unreliable, or they're only as reliable as their most vulnerable pylon. That's not the way to go. And by doing that, he's showing a preference for energy democracy and many other ways as well.
I think that you picking out the electric grid is really important. And this is one of those things that it's kind of a nerdy subject and people don't focus on it. But he talks about things like, you know, what we would do in the grid is use existing rights of ways, not building new paths for new projects, as you say, cutting across virgin land. And he also talks quite a bit about energy storage and taking advantage of the possibilities of really, when you start talking about energy storage, you're starting to talk about integrating renewable energy into community systems. And that, I think, is where it could kind of be a basis for the kind of energy democracy, community-driven plans also, that you talk about.
Right. He also discusses at least promises to appropriate, that is, to get the Congress to appropriate. And it's not he. It's obviously a planning group that put this together, including a lot of people who are interested in energy democracy, it appears from the plan. He calls for mass transit monies for all cities of more than 100,000 people. well, most of Americans. It's an enormous program, and it really, with mass transit, you don't need all those private cars, even though he sort of reaches out to the auto industry and auto workers that we're going to be building more cars in the future. But mass transit for 100,000...
That is a very impressive goal. I was looking at what that would mean. And if you take Oregon, for example, that's not just Portland, but also Salem and Eugene and Gresham and Hillsborough and Bend. It really reaches that deeply into the whole nation. And
yeah, especially if you're not just talking about the city itself and the boundaries, but the city and its suburbs has, there are like 2 million people in the Portland.
Right. You're right. You have to look at the cities and the surrounding suburbs to see how many cars you could get off the road by enhancing mass transit. And he also talks about improving the existing transit systems and building on them and having paths for bicycles and pedestrians. We've built these suburbs and cities, but certainly the suburbs. We've built them around the car. And in the future, even now, the city that I live near, Washington, D.C., is completely choked. And it hurts the quality of life here, how much car traffic we have. And everybody who lives here realizes that. And we realize that there is much need to be less reliant on cars. And of course, through this pandemic, we've all had the experience of reducing traffic and reducing our leaving the home. And I think he'll be building on the fact that a lot of people have realized we don't need as much driving in cars as we have in the past.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm talking to Marianne Lavelle of the journal Inside Climate News. We've been discussing Biden's climate action plans, not just his. People have described it as a huge grab bag, but in fact, it rejects business as usual and looks to a very different future if you read between the lines and, in fact, many of the lines of the plan. And it includes many provisions that support building out what the plan of energy democracy. So, Marianne Lavelle, you know Washington, D.C. Let's say Biden wins and the Democrats take over the Senate and a few more Sanders-type Democrats enter the Congress. Now, if that happens, I don't expect that the left radically democratic program, energy democracy, will be adopted in any big, huge program on its own. But could the left in Congress win some many billions for it? I think the Biden administration needs the left in Congress if they want to pile up majority votes in the Congress. And the left could make demands, I think, that could prevail. What's your sense?
Yes, you raise a really important question, and that's how do you make this happen? And how do you make sure that things move in the direction of what you're calling energy democracy instead of just moving in the old familiar corporate-friendly path? I've been working on, we're going to do a big project that starts next week about the Senate races. And the one thing that really comes home is whether or not the Democrats flip the Senate. In 2021, that Senate is going to be very closely divided. Either the Democrats will be in charge or the Republicans will be in control. But it's going to be very close, just as it is now. And that's not to say it doesn't make a difference. But what I'm saying is that even if the Democrats win, there's going to be a lot of work ahead for those who care about these issues to really make their voices heard, because corporate lobbyists will certainly be making their voices heard. So I would say that advocates of community solutions on climate, they should be anticipating that, and they should be working now to put together their proposals, and they should be talking to their representatives in Congress, talking to their representatives of both parties, making the pitch for a real community-based approach being part of this, because I think it's almost a given that if Biden wins, he is going to have a new stimulus bill very soon. And so what are we going to be spending the money on? Is the money going to go to saving the oil and gas industry, which is what some of the money has gone to in the original stimulus? Or is it going to be building a new way of organizing ourselves around our use of energy? And I think, again, the corporate lobbyists are already ready for this. And those who care about these issues, the election is just the first step. There is continued need for action and persuading your representatives that this is really what the people want back home.
Yeah, my guess is it'll also take really enormous nationwide marches and protests and demonstrations to push what is a conservative Congress. Most Democrats also see themselves as moderates. So it's going to take all sorts of movement work, but including talking to representatives and making demands and putting the heat on. But it also is going to have to be partly in the streets and actually great demonstrations.
Yes, I would say showing how many numbers of people care about these things, as well as making the case for it, that will be part of the advocacy that's needed.
Marianne Lavelle, thanks so much for talking to us, and looking forward to your work on Inside Climate News, which can be found on the web.
You'll find us at InsideClimateNews.org.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Marianne.
Great talking to you too, Bill. And thank you so much for reading our publication and asking such good questions. And look forward to talking again in the future.
That would be great.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Marianne Lavelle. Coming up, I talk with Joe Clement about Multnomah County library worker self-organization in the face of threatened layoffs. Before that, some more music from Victor Jara. But first, I want to remind you that this is fall drive time at KBOO. You can show your support by donating today at kboo.fm/give. As I mentioned, we aren't in the station to take your calls, something we've done for decades but can't now because of the coronavirus. You can, however, show your support by giving online. And we have a two-for-one special. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, in Portland. While you go to that website or write a check, here's Victor Jara with some more from El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, followed by my conversation with Joe Clement. Labor Day special. We are joined on the Old Mole with Joe Clement. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Norm.
And happy Labor Day to you.
Happy Labor Day to you.
Joe is not only a member of the Old Mole, and you've heard him, of course, on this program many, many times, but is a union member and a worker at Multnomah County Library. Very interesting struggle there at the library. Joe, walk us through. What are the high points?
Well, as many of the listeners may know, the library has proposed layoffs over the summer, and those layoffs are unjustifiable on a number of grounds. The layoffs are supposed to be based off of social distancing constraints. They use the phrase stewardship of public money and the fact that a number of staff have been on paid administrative leave because of children or because of their health risks or their family health risks. What makes this all so suspect is the fact that we are not in a budget crisis. The budget for the library with the staff that are now being cut was passed at the end of June. And the cuts come at a time when the library is gearing up to promote a bond on the November ballot, a capital bond, a bond to raise $387 million to build new libraries and renovate several others and also bring automation to the libraries. And so the question of fiscal responsibility and the assumption that because lots of other government agencies are facing budget cuts because of revenue shortfalls, that the library is no different than that. But there are actually particulars about the library situation that make layoffs or cuts to staff and services quite unconscionable in this moment.
That's worth emphasizing, isn't it, Joe, that normally when we hear about layoffs, it's because there's a shortage, or at least management claims that they lack funds somehow, or they lack revenue. That's not the case with the library system. They are flush with money and yet are laying off workers. My neighborhood, there are flyers up on behalf of library workers. What's been the response by the workers who are members of the union? This is worth emphasizing. They're members of Ask Me Local 88.
The library workers have been organizing for mutual aid and self-defense, both of themselves as workers, but also for the communities that we serve, who are going to be impacted in very material ways by the cuts as well. And we have been communicating amongst ourselves to understand the situation and to identify our own solutions for it, many of which have been taken by management, but have not been taken in good faith. And the workers are making a point of telling the public what is happening with their resources, because management, and this includes the county commissioners, who will repeat management lines in their responses to emails written about this, reduce the library as a public service to its financial dimension. The emphasis on money is one way of expressing this, but it's also present in the way that they want to lower labor costs in order to use that money and money in the capital bond, should it pass, to invest in structures and technologies that will decrease labor overhead. It will not necessarily mean that the work is easier for us all, because they do not want to expand the workforce. But this is, I think, a difference that is important to understand, because the library is not just a collection of commodities, including workers as bought and sold commodities. We are a community and we provide services. And what the public enjoys from us is a direct set of relationships and a direct kind of service in the form of goods, educational, informational, cultural goods, the relationships and the educational support that library workers as workers of information provide, that this is not something that is simply bought and sold. And it's coming from the workers. It's not coming from the wages. It's not coming from whatever can be saved by laying off the workers, cutting positions. And
what are some concrete instances of how the public will be affected by layoffs?
Well, there will be fewer services like story time. There will be slower times, or you'll have longer waits for your holds because there'll be fewer staff to actually manage the physical process of finding a book, moving it from here to there so patrons can access it.
Well, it's workers that are going to be affected, of course, and the public, the workers themselves, those who are laid off, those who are sped up as a result of having fewer workers to provide services, and then the way you've talked about the consequences for the public. Let me ask a more specific question then, and that has to do in this day and age and with our alertness to racism in this society. How about workers of color in particular?
It has been brought up in the media by BIPOC workers that these cuts are going to disproportionately affect them. And there are two ways of looking at this, one which management has been promoting and then one which the workers are promoting. Management wants to frame the disproportionate impact of their choice to make unnecessary cuts on BIPOC workers. They want to frame that in terms of seniority and in terms of just how the contract, the union contract, decides how these things happen. The workers see that because the cuts are unnecessary, that the root cause of this impact is not the way that seniority works, though the way that this seems to be the issue comes out of historic hiring patterns, which have meant that for generations, it was white folks who had the privilege of getting a job with the library. And in recent years, management has shifted. They have been, as they say, centering race and focusing on creating more positions for and hiring people of color, Black and Indigenous workers, although Indigenous workers do not have special protection, they have been used nonetheless by the library for their culture and knowledge in promoting library services to Indigenous communities. And because of those historic hiring practices, the seniority system ends up meaning that the cuts fall on those who have been hired more recently. But the fundamental issue is that the cuts are unnecessary, not that there is something wrong with how seniority works to create this disproportionate impact.
So again, and more specifically, there's a disproportionate impact to Black, Indigenous, and people of color workers, but also to communities that those workers serve. We're seeing consequences for management intentions, management practices across the board. Joe, tell us something more about then the response by workers, because this is in fact a fascinating instance of workers responding, coming up with alternatives on their own. I would not hesitate to call this an instance of worker self-organization.
The workers have been self-organizing, and it has, you know, been a not exactly leaderless movement, but it has been the kind of thing where leaders are organically stepping up, being validated by the trust and support of their coworkers around whatever initiative it is. And then as those initiatives rise, we connect them and we are able to build our capacity to communicate with the public, to digest the information that we are getting from management, but also that we are seeing in the public, because the public is being persuaded to not view this as the problem that it is. And we have been organizing ourselves to not be bowled over by these changes. We held a picket, which is a lawful and contractually permissible act to inform the public, and in particular one of our commissioners at the Midland Library last Monday. It was a successful event that workers led. and that we, you know, intend to do more of, because the claim in the media now is that the layoffs have been averted. Management has worked out a deal with the county to offer positions in the coronavirus pandemic response department that we call the Emergency Operations Center, positions in this center to otherwise laid off workers. And they're trying to say that they have averted laying off all of the workers, leaving out the fact that they are cutting positions from the library. They are cutting positions that exist as vacancies. They have incentivized, but by many accounts, emotionally coerced workers to take early retirement or voluntary layoffs. And the remaining workers who would be facing, you know, a layoff at the end of September have this chance to still technically have county employment. But that completely obfuscates the fact that the cuts still exist. There's only been a very modest handful of services that have been proposed to carve out the proposed cuts. And so we are going to continue organizing to fight these cuts, because the cuts are what are hurting the library and the community. The fact that some folks are not going to face immediate unemployment doesn't change the fact that they too have been traumatized by this whole process. And our work is to continue to build our political base, which is our community who we serve, and our fellow coworkers who are being impacted by this. And it's all of us, whether you got a cut or not. An injury to one is an injury to all. And it's being felt very widely throughout the library that we have to stand up together for each other, because they're trying to take us down in every classification.
Now, one aspect of that resistance, and unfortunately we're going to have to deal with this very briefly, is not only the community outreach that you've described and the self-organization, people pulling together, but actually taking on kind of what are normally management prerogatives, and that is thinking of alternative jobs. Workers thinking of jobs that they could and should be doing.
Yeah, the workers have suggested dozens and dozens of ideas for programming. When the layoffs were announced, management allowed a committee to be formed in cooperation with the union, staffed by labor and management, to review these suggestions and make recommendations for new services that would ultimately mean fewer jobs cut. Some of these that have been moved to the forefront include assisting folks trying to find jobs or learn new job skills, assistance with folks, especially parents, who are managing home learning for their children or themselves, extending more virtual services to immigrant populations that rely on the library for gaining English skills, for navigating the process of acquiring citizenship, and for actually taking their oath and becoming official citizens of the United States.
Wonderful. I want to emphasize these are needs that workers themselves are seeing and are proposing to fill, as against management efforts just to lay people off.
And they would not exist. I want to emphasize that they would not exist by management's fiat. Management did not have a plan until workers were forcing them to take seriously their own plans.
Joe, thank you very much for talking with us. This is a struggle by library workers in Multnomah County. We will continue to follow. That was Joe Clement. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The conversation with Joe Clement continues online when today's program is posted to the Old Mole website. In particular, we talk further about how issues of race have figured both into the library management's layoffs and into worker responses. You can also look at the website created by the library workers. That's savelibrarystaff.org. Save Library Staff is all one word. It's a very well done and informative website. Joe also wants to emphasize how KABU, this radio station, has been the only one in town to offer the library workers a hearing. As a result, we are getting exclusive radio coverage of an important instance of worker initiative, worker self-organizing. Something to keep in mind as you decide to support KBOO. I'd like to thank everyone on the show today. Old Moles, Patricia Kohlberg, Bill Resnick, and their guests, Marianne Lavelle, Leslie Gregory, and Joe Clement. And a special thanks to the resourceful staff at KBOO. It's KBOO that keeps the station going when so many others around the country have had to close. As we approach 9/11 later in the week, the Old Mole leaves you with a bit more of Victor Jara.
Indochina es el lugar más allá del ancho mar donde revientan la flor con genocidio y napalm. La luna es una explosión.